You're listening to the Paranormal Patio Podcast. Pull up a chair.
Welcome back to Paranormal Patio. As always, it's me, I'm Jason, and I'm not alone. You know, you're probably used to that by now. I seem to always have someone with me. Well, that's because I like people. And I like these people very much. I'd like to welcome Sarah and AJ from Mystere Creations. They are here tonight to talk about the special book that's incredibly rare, really hard to find. They happen to have a copy of it. And I said, hey, I really want to know what's in this book. And Sarah has taken immaculate notes, copious amounts of notes on this book. She has essentially written a book about the book. The book is Weird Egypt, The Case for Supernatural Geology. And you think, Weird Egypt, okay, we're going to talk about Egypt. No, actually, we're talking about Little Egypt in southern Illinois. Basically, the entire southern part of Illinois, collectively known as Little Egypt, it includes the Shawnee National Forest. And if you've listened to my show before, you know I'm a big fan of the Shawnee National Forest. I love going there. I love being there. I love the environment. I've never really had anything inherently weird happen to me there, but I have been to a lot of the places that we're going to talk about, and I have had some feelings about a lot of places. I actually have a very, very, very important place that to me is sort of like a power spot. I feel drawn there whenever I'm there. I can't think of anywhere I'd rather be. I don't talk about that place very often, so when we cover it, I think in this episode, I will share my thoughts on said place. But I'm getting ahead of myself. We're here to talk with Sarah and AJ about Jim Young's book, Weird Egypt. Guys, welcome to the Paranormal Patio. How are you?
We're doing great.
It's good to be here, man.
In unison. That was great. Almost in unison. I love it. You know, it's so genuine and fun. And, you know, I'm really glad to have you guys here today. Thank you so much for coming on. I know that we have talked a lot. Actually, in the last episode, we even talked about it a little bit. But you guys have a project going on called Mystere Creations. And you have a podcast and a lot of online content. You're doing some preservation of folklore, which I think is amazing and great. And I'm, you know, incredibly grateful for the work that you guys do. It's purposeful and worthwhile work. I know sometimes it probably feels like a burden, but the fact that you're doing something that is really important for society, it's something that's overlooked. And, you know, hats off to you both for your hard work, you know.
Thank you. Same goes to you, man. You're doing a great job in the patio.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, the weather is changing. We are headed for spring, for brighter times. I'm coming out of illness that has not quite been debilitating, but might as well have been in certain times in the last few weeks. So I'm looking forward to getting allergies now because of all this. Clear up the sinus infection and get the allergies. It's great. You know, but we don't live in a sterile environment, and our environment is constantly being invaded by not only allergens, but also the weird, which is what we love so much. So we're going to talk about this book, Weird Egypt. First of all right, this book, people are selling kidneys for this book. How did you guys get this book?
You posted on Liminal Lodge you were looking for it, and I literally just found it in a Google search.
It's not fair at all. It's not fair at all.
She found it.
I did post it. You just didn't want to buy it, and I waited, and then I was like, oh, I'm going to go visit my parents so I can ship it to there, and bought it.
Okay, so this is the same one that you were like, oh, gosh, it was a lot of money, and I was like, I just can't pull the trigger on it.
So I don't know why I shipped it to the States, but I got charged. It was like $99. Then they charged me an import fee, even though I wasn't importing it. So it ended up $134 American.
I don't think that was the same one that I found, because I was thinking I would have pulled the trigger on a $90 book. This had to have been another copy.
It was the same link. I literally just saved the post, and I as soon as I knew I was going to go visit my parents, I was like, oh, no one's bought it. So I bought it.
Oh, man, I'm really kicking myself. We were talking before we started recording about how I used to have a copy of the book Phone Calls from the Dead that I bought for a quarter that is now worth, what's the going rate for the hardcover copy?
It's $2,000 or $3,000.
Yeah. So I bought that for a quarter with the dust jacket in good shape. And that was like 20 years ago. And I have no idea where it is. That's book number one in the collection of missed opportunities. And then this book, Weird Egypt, The Case for Supernatural Geology, is book number two on that shelf of missed opportunities. But I'm glad that it went to someone who appreciates it. And, you know, you're willing to share the information. So that's good.
When I received it, I believe it's a woman who knew Jim. She wrote me a handwritten note and gave me a free almanac that he had written.
That's right, because Jim wrote like an almanac series. What was that? What was that called?
Oh, I can't remember. It's in the bedroom.
Oh no, it's fine. It's not that big of a deal. But I don't remember how many years he did it. I looked into finding copies of that too, and they're just as hard to find. You know, this was a guy that did independent publishing, I believe, for most of his work. I don't know, would you consider Jim, like, was he actively a biologist, a geologist? What really was he?
There's not a lot of personal information, but he just feels like an amateur. It's almost like what the volunteers do here for the nature sanctuary. They don't have any...
They don't have credentials, but they're experts in their...
Yeah, they know how to, so it's just like, I think he was just, because in the book, he was working for the university on some of the buildings, so I don't know if he was like an architect, so I feel like he just loved
I think he was an engineer.
Yeah, so I think he loved where he lived, and he had friendships from the university, so I think it was just kind of one of those things.
And the university that we're talking about is in Carbondale, Illinois. And I'm going to verify the name of the university. It's Southern Illinois University, SIU, that we call it locally. I'm a little further northeast of that, but I'm definitely familiar with Carbondale, been to Carbondale multiple times. I had some friends that went to school at SIU, actually, you know, around the time that this book was being formulated in the brain of Jim Young, which is really interesting. And I have reached out to some libraries and bookstores in the Carbondale area to try to find this stinking book. And they're like, it's a holy grail. You'll never find it. So just going back to the scarcity of it, you know, being like an independent publisher and putting this information out, which is just, you know, amazing information, but it is kind of niche. It's like, you probably won't be interested in this unless you live in the area, right?
It feels like it's got a John Keel feel to it, though. Like, I feel like if this book was more widely published, it would be kind of John Keel-ish, because it talks about, like, science, and then there's
the ghosts. Weird. It's a good mix of both weird and science. For me, I came into it the day that she was reading about tectonic strain theory in the book. And then we had flashes of light. And it turns out there was nothing to corroborate that to, like,
there was some power lines like 5, 6, 7, 8 streets over, and we're at the bottom of a hill, so yeah. Like, but the chances of us seeing the power line, and it looked like lightning. Like, if you think about when you don't see the actual bolt, you just see the flash, it was exactly like that, but turquoise, but no lightning strike anywhere north of California.
When you see a transformer explode, it's usually a yellow greenish blast, and you hear an explosion. We heard no explosion. It just lit up the sky, and it did it 2 or 3 more times and then was gone. And then we started finding out, okay, there's ghost lights and lights being seen around fault lines. And in the area we live, not far from us, is a whole eggshell of fault lines. And it just wasn't explainable. And that's where I came into
it. It looked exactly like the lights that were filmed in Mexico that are considered earthquake lights.
It's really interesting. Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely interesting. And I know that Jim covers a lot of that, you know, the tectonic strain theory. And, you know, I would like to visit that at some point. And I think, you know, maybe that would even be interesting bonus content for the Patreon to talk about that, especially the lights that somehow seem to manifest from this. And you guys have read more about it than I have. So I can't even briefly explain it now. Suffice it to say that we will visit that though in the future at some point. You know, I don't want to get super science heavy with the discussion. It's going to come up. I mean, this is what his theory was on, you know, a lot of the explanations for the events that people are reporting. And I mean, to my understanding, and yeah, it's definitely worth mentioning for sure, because, you know, things happen all around the world that people don't feel like they can explain. And maybe this is an explanation for some of that, you know, the tectonic strain theory. So especially when you talk about the earthquake lights that people have, you know, filmed and things in Mexico and other places too, you know, and then there's like ball lightning and things like that, which I think we actually talked, AJ and I talked about ball lightning a little bit, whenever we met up on the season three, I think, AJ, is that right?
It was season three, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we've talked about a little bit about Jim. He's from Carbondale. He passed away not that long ago, which makes finding this book even more difficult, because I feel like maybe if he were alive, another edition would have come out. I believe his wife put out a second edition of the book, a second printing, not necessarily an edition. I don't think she changed anything. I think it's just a second printing.
I have the second printing. She did change it slightly. She fixed some of his mistakes and put in some notes. And the interesting thing is, I think she writes the foreword, or someone writes the foreword. I'm pretty sure it's her. But Jim had an obsession with this book. Like an absolute obsession with this book. And so it suggests, like, you know, his wife was very patient. And shortly after it was published, he passed away.
Yeah, that's terrible. But like, it's so poetic, right? Like, he had to get it out. He had all this information. He wanted to get it collected. He wanted to share it. He had to get it out. And he did. And he's like, well, my work is done. Like, it's time to ride off into the sunset. Yeah, it's very poetic. You know, I love it. So we were discussing before we started, and I'd like to kind of do a little bit of a breakdown. We're going to talk about a couple of counties today, and depending on how it goes and how we feel about it and how we feel we're able to present the information, we will maybe pick it up for another episode or maybe even more. You know, we could have an entire series about Weird Egypt, the Weird Egyptian series, if you will. So I asked you, if it would be okay if we talked about a couple of counties that are more pertinent to me, just my favorite spots to go to. And we're going to talk a little bit about Gallatin County and Hardin County. And we will start with Gallatin County. And I'm going to kind of, you know, just turn the reins over to you a little bit on what you think are the most interesting things about it. And I'll bring up a few things too, because there's a place in Gallatin County that we're going to get to that I want to talk about that I have been to, and it's no longer open to the public, which is both good and bad. But we're going to talk about the Crenshaw House, locally known as the Old Slave House. And there's some dark, twisted things there, not necessarily paranormal, but important to talk about. So let's talk about this Gallatin County area. I'm looking at your notes here, and the thing that is interesting about a lot of Southern Illinois is actually that it's rich in salt. And I wonder if there's some connection between, I don't know, like the salt content. Like, you think about deer, like, you know, loving to lick salts, and other animals like to lick salt. You put out salt licks whenever you're preparing areas for hunting. I wonder if there's something supernatural about salt too. You think maybe the ghosties or the monsters are into licking salt? You know, that's why they hang out in the Shawnee Forest.
There definitely is something, because I know when I lived in Indiana, the places that were salt lick counties, they had a lot of paranormal too. So maybe it's because, like, it's salt water and it's, can't you, salt water, isn't it slightly electrified? Like, it can conduct electricity. Ionized,
so,
yeah, yeah.
But also, salt is used as a purifier. Mm-hmm. And if you're looking to keep something out of your house, you put salt along the windows and doors to keep stuff out. But in reality, if you have something already in your house and you do that, you trap it in your house. So if there's salt all around the area, it's keeping whatever's there in.
I never thought about that. The salt, the ancient seabed trapping energy. I never thought about that.
That's interesting, right? And there's a lot of places that we'll find, you know, that are really high in salt content in not just southern Illinois, but western Kentucky as well. Even going into the Mammoth Cave system, you know, there's a lot of salt mines there. So interesting. It was just something that I had thought about just now reading your notes as they're in front of me. Let's talk about, I don't want to do too much history unless it's also weird, but suffice it to say, there's a lot of ancient people evidence, you know, here in southern Illinois.
Yes. Yeah. There was a prehistoric people, which this book really didn't give a lot of information, so I got to look that up. And then there's the Mississippian culture, which is all through southern Illinois.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you, as time moves on, the French were a big, a determining factor in the outcome of the way things changed in the area. As far north, you know, even into my area, in your notes here, where you're talking about a place known as Half Moon Lick, you mentioned in the 1730s, French settlers established a settlement at Vincennes, which is actually in Indiana. That, if you remember the first episode of season 3, I talked to my friend Keith about his Bigfoot encounter. Keith actually comes from French native mixed peoples from Vincennes area. So it's interesting to have another callback to previous work here. So yeah, Vincennes was actually known as New France for some time. And it's only about 40 minutes from my house. And this is coming up again already. We're talking about Half Moon Lick, or I'm looking at Half Moon Lick, and we're talking about mining the salt. This comes up a lot. Slaves being imported here at Half Moon Lick, which is southwest of Equality, Illinois. And that's going to come into the very next topic, which is one of the things I wanted to talk about, the old slave house. What can you guys tell us about the old slave house, also known as Hickory Hill Manor?
So for those who may be confused, because Illinois is written on paper as a free, no slave state. It was no slave state, comma, except when imported slaves are brought in to mine salt.
Yeah.
So John, I did some more research. John Duff lived in the Kentucky side so that he could send his slaves to the salt mines. And he was a, they don't say it technically, but when you read the history, he was a business partner of John Crenshaw, who was a terrible businessman who failed at all of his businesses and was a ruthless slave owner. He was also part of the regulators. They terrorized free black people in Illinois and in the reverse Underground Railroad, where they would kidnap free black people and send them to states where they had no rights.
Yeah. And this house that Crenshaw built in Gallatin County, I have been there, and for whatever reason, it's one of those odd, like, tourism spots. Like, you wouldn't think about going to a slave plantation as a tourist. However, there are multiple reasons for that, which I will briefly attempt to highlight here, that it's an educational opportunity to present a largely untouched environment where terrible history happened, so that you may learn about how to not act as a person. Crenshaw was a piece of shit. I'm going to be frank and be blunt about it. He was a terrible, terrible person. He did awful, awful things that are unforgivable. The fact that they don't refer to this property as the Crenshaw House, anyone that I have ever talked to, is a testament to the fact that he deserves no remembrance whatsoever. We refer to it as the old slave house, which is not particularly a PC and grabbing title. However, you know what you're getting when someone mentions it's the old slave house, right? You know that it was it's an old slave house. And you had mentioned the reverse underground railroad. So he builds this house in the 1830s, according to your notes, that has underneath the house where a carriage can pull into the basement, essentially. And it is one of the first indoor garages. They would do this so that in the night they could transport people without anyone knowing who's inside this carriage, and take captured slaves back to slave-friendly states in the South, which is just hideous, absolutely hideous. One thing that I remember mostly about this place is the attic. Even as a child, you go up to the attic and there's just, the walls are just holding cells, iron bars, chains hanging on the wall, like handcuffs, crude handcuffs, just a terrible, terrible place. There's stains on the wall. That I don't know if they were put in after the fact, you know, for attention grabbing, for tourism. They would always tell stories. And I remember there was a rumor that went around everywhere, even as far north as where I am, that a radio station did a contest. If anyone can spend the night in the old slave house, they got like $10,000, and no one could ever do it because of how haunted it was. Now, if any of that is true, I don't know, but that was definitely the rumor going around, which I thought, you know, as a kid, I thought that's interesting, you know?
And, I mixed up my notes. Sorry. It wasn't John Duff. It was James Ford. That is the one that lived in Kentucky on the Ohio.
Oh, okay. So, but we're going to talk about John Duff too, I think.
Yeah.
So yeah, this Crenshaw house used to be, I'm going to probably butcher this. Okay. It was open to the public. It was privately owned. The people that owned the property lived in part of the house that had been remodeled. The other part was left to its historical state and maintained. But whenever I'm wanting to say it was in the mid-90s, maybe the late-90s, the state bought the property or acquired the property from the owners. And the rumor going around was that it could no longer be a public area because it needed to be handicap accessible. But they were forbidden from making the changes to the property to make it handicap accessible because of its historical status. So it fell into this limbo state where the state, I think, still owns it, but it can't be made public because it can't be modified to be made public to meet the criteria. So now there's a gate in the drive, which is just off of Illinois Route 1 in Gallatin County. If you're going south, it's on the right-hand side, so it'd be on the west side of Illinois Route 1. There's about a 15-foot section of gravel road. The gate is right there, and you can see the house up on the hill, up on Hickory Hill, and you can see it. I think there's actually a few videos on YouTube, if you look this up, where you can see the property with a drone. And it looks exactly the same as I remember it whenever I was a kid, you know, which it should, I guess.
Yeah, and it is private property now. So a lot of the places we'll talk about are probably private property. So do not criminal trespass. It is not worth it.
Yeah, absolutely not. Do not condone that whatsoever.
But if you do, take notes.
No, AJ.
No, but for real, don't do it. Do you have anything else that you'd like to add about the old slave house that I haven't touched on?
No, you talked about he had the first indoor garage. Like, all of the information on him is just awful. Like, he was awful, awful, awful. And it talks about his family and how they're trying to say he was misunderstood, which I 100% understand. I would not want that on my name if I was like the grand. Oh, yes, there is something interesting I found out. He reminded me. So, John Crenshaw is the great-great-grandfather of the alligator man, Joe Ball, who is a serial killer in Texas who killed women and fed them to alligators.
Oh, man.
That was on the Wikipedia. I was like, well, that's weird. I'm adding that to the notes.
That makes sense, though. I mean, this is the type of people, you know, awful. One thing I just remembered about this place that I didn't mention was, I remember when you walked into the living room or parlor, that's the from the front door you walk in, you know, you can see the staircase going up. I'm trying to relive this visually. To the right, there's a bedroom that had a small fence over the doorway so you couldn't go in it. They said, and I don't know if it's true, that at one point, Abraham Lincoln had visited the property and had stayed the night in that bedroom and did not know that there were slaves on the property. And he stayed the night one night and he left the next day. And for some reason, they expect you to believe that they kept the room exactly as it was then after the night Lincoln stayed there. I don't know what the motivation was, if it's just adding to the tourism-y stuff. But I do remember that, and I always thought that was weird.
I did research a little bit of the Civil War, but I don't remember which side. I think Illinois was going to the Confederacy and then quickly changed sides, because I think if that was them.
Yeah, we were definitely in the Union. I don't
know. Okay.
Early stages, I'm not sure where. I'm going to be honest with you. Today, if we relive the Civil War experiment, I believe the Illinois from Chicago south, from south of Chicago, would want to be in the Confederacy. It sickens me. I wouldn't want to be personally, but in large, most of Southern Illinois would definitely want to be in the Confederacy.
I'm pretty sure when I read the history, it was they were going to be Confederates, but then they saw that it was going to be a bad time for them, and they quickly changed to Union. However, I will say it did take the federal emancipation to free the last slaves in Illinois. So they were Union, but they didn't free the slaves until the federal injunction.
Incredible. Incredible. To change gears, you mentioned John Duff, and we said that we would bring up John Duff. The Duff spook light. What can you tell us about the Duff spook light?
There has been, so spook light, if people don't know what that is, it's just a will-o-wisp. What is it? A railroad lantern, sometimes they say.
Ghost lights.
They're balls of light, and they're usually like blue or red, I think.
And or they could be both, or alternating between.
Yeah, and so people would see it in the area where he would have his, it would have been along the banks of the Saline River, and the specific area, I didn't write it down, but it's owned by the forestry, so it's like farmland and then this green square where his headquarters was. They would see a spook light there, and they used to say it's where his treasure
is buried.
That's and interesting. Yeah. No, because we remember, I had mentioned it briefly off the air too, that earlier this season I talked to Vincent Truewell, and we talked about Russell Burroughs finding this cave full of treasure that Harry Ubbard thinks is the tomb of Alexander the Great and company. And that's, you know, sort of almost considered being in Little Egypt, so being in part of this area. And you talk about finding treasure. We also, I go back to the Knights of the Golden Circle having a presence in Southern Illinois, in Gallatin County, as a matter of fact, where there is a known meeting place in the Shawnee Forest near Garden of the Gods. And they're known, the Knights of the Golden Circle, known for their infamous gold caches that are buried all over Kentucky. So the treasure comes back.
Yeah, I'd have to look up when he was alive, but I feel like if he was alive during the Civil War, he would have helped the Knights of the Golden Circle, because he was a counterfeiter and a con man, and they were specifically, part of what they did was just sabotage the Union. So it'd be interesting to go back and look and see if there was crossover.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes total sense. Your notes say the areas he frequented have a high frequency of ghosts, haunts, and otherworldly phenomena. That's fun.
It's interesting.
If, per se, he had this treasure, and if it is the treasure of Alexander the Great, that would have spiritual attachments and possibly energy attachments from centuries of whatever. And in truth, during this time period, there was a huge trade in Egyptian artifacts throughout the world.
Artifacts, period. Like, during this time period, there was no respect given to any artifacts.
So, who knows what is buried there? They name the name of the book is Weird Egypt. So, think of it. If there's a mummy buried there, disturbing mummies notoriously had curses involved.
Well, I think that's like I know Nathan talks about this a little bit, about how and why places got their names, and like I think everything he says is valid, but I also think like here in BC there's like 7 places named Hecate, and it really is just, it was a Freemason who was an explorer, and he's like Hecate Mountain, Hecate the pass between Haida Gwaii and Hecate this. And I think it's just like, you and I are geeks. We would be like, let's name that Enki, you know, like.
Yeah. You name it for something that you're interested in.
Yeah. Right. So it's hard to say, is it something weird or is it just a Freemason having fun?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. You look at naming things, and the town that I grew up in was, hopefully I'm not doxing myself, was originally known as Henpeck. And it was because there was one guy who had a store there, and it was called, his name was Henry Peck. And people said, we're going to Henpeck's. Then it became known as Henpeck. And whenever the phraseology caught up, and people started saying that someone was henpecked if they did everything their wife said, the town was like, no, we can't have that. We got to change our name. So going down the list here, and I see the Vanguard warning, a 19th century paranormal incident. What can you tell us about Ernest Vanguard and the Vanguard warning?
So he was traveling home one night when apparently a coffin crossed his path. I believe when I was reading the story, he was on a horse. So he was going along. He ignored it, kept going. It followed him the whole way. Next day, same thing. Then when he was walking with his friends, he was like, do you see that? Do you see that? Do you see that? And they were like, what are you talking about? And so he ends up going off to the side, and the coffin tells him, some people are going to come to your house. They're going to invite you to a dance. Don't go. A few days later, when the invitation came, he refused. And then he heard that there was trouble at the dance and several people had been wounded.
Yeah. Just seeing a traveling phantom coffin that only you can see, that gives you a warning about going to a dance you haven't even been invited to yet. That's so wild.
And there's like, I don't know which county, I'm not going to look for it, but there's another story about a guy on his horse who saw a white, so imagine a bolster pillow, something that looked like that. And it ends in the cemetery. And like 2 years later, his wife that he married shortly after seeing that was buried in the exact spot where that pillow was buried.
Wild.
It's a foretelling of death.
It's crazy.
That's very Sleepy Hollow-esque, though.
There is, in Southern Illinois, there's lots of ghostly encounters along the road systems.
Yeah, and it's not just Southern Illinois, because there's the cemetery in Chicago that, I don't remember, Resurrection Cemetery, I think is what it's called. That there's a woman in a prom dress that is hitchhiking down the road, and you pick her up, and she tells you that she wants to go to the cemetery, and she gets out and disappears. I've been to the cemetery a long, long time ago. I think I was in high school, and it was at night, and the gates were closed. I couldn't go in, didn't see anything. But the girl, multiple people, like dozens and dozens of people, have picked this girl up and taken her into the cemetery where she disappears. It's fascinating.
Is that the cemetery with the angel that her eyes didn't age because it's copper?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think I've heard of that.
Yeah, there's, I think it's an angel or Grim Reaper, and it's in Chicago. And it's a beautiful cemetery because it's where all the wealthy people are buried. So there's lots of really interesting tombstones. I was a teenager, couldn't tell you which one it was. But there is a Grim Reaper or an angel, and it's famous. So I'm sure if I did the research, I'd be able to find it. But the way the statue is, the eyes have not turned green.
Weird.
But the rest of her is green.
That's weird.
Because it's copper.
That's weird because it should turn green.
Especially like in Chicago, it'll rain in every direction at once.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That there's no reason why that shouldn't have, you know, turned. I haven't heard of that before. That's neat. Going back to warnings of death, Gallatin County seems to be filthy with them. You know, you had the coffin, but then also, there's a story about a banshee that was attached to this family in Shawneetown. Not a lot to talk about here, really. But after the family left, no other reports of this banshee were reported. And of course, the banshee is the historical Irish death bringer that announces the death of someone in the family of the person who hears it. I believe that's correct. Is that right, AJ?
There's a number of different tellings. But it's usually about around the same sort of situation.
The funny thing about this story was I had to go into Ancestry because when I went on the page, I was like, excuse me, because that is my mother's maiden name, different McConnell. So they were not in Illinois at the time of when this family lived there, but it was just so weird that out of all of the last names, it was slightly spelled differently than my mother's maiden name. And I'm like, there's been so many synchronicities. Like shortly after I came home with this book, I went to Walmart in Victoria and there was an Illinois State Trooper Hot Wheel at Walmart. And they just kept happening all through reading this book.
No, that's crazy. Yeah, they make a Hot Wheel of an Illinois State Trooper car.
Yeah. Yes, I didn't buy it, and I feel like I probably should because that would have been hilarious. But I was like, what in the world? We're in Canada. We're on the West Coast. Like, why is this here?
Wow. That's weird. I mean, that's not like, you know, paranormal weird, but it's weird that they make it. It's also kind of paranormal weird that you had that encounter the same day. That's, you know, synchronicity at its finest.
Yep.
Love it. The only other really notable thing in your notes about Gallatin County is there's this story about killing a witch. 1830s folk tale of Charles Lowry. What can you tell us about that?
It was 1830s and he thought he was bewitched. So a friend told him to put a needle under the hearth and burn it to be rid of the witch. Just before he was able to do that, a messenger came to the door on behalf of the witch. Once for needle, the second it was for Charles to come over. He refused both times, and apparently the witch died after that.
So, like, the witch comes over to stop him, basically, like, you know, don't put that needle
in. No, it was an elderly neighbor on behalf of the witch.
Oh, okay, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's kind of a wild story, though. Not a whole lot of stories about witches, I guess, in the traditional, like, poorly informed sense that this implies, you know, the sort of, like, I don't know, horror and Halloween.
There is one in Alcorn Creek, but when you read it in the book, it's clearly just like their neighbor was, insert swear word, and harassed these poor people.
Ah, gotcha.
They were not witches.
They weren't witches, they were bitches.
Yeah.
What happens quite often is a lot of these so-called witches were cunning folk and charmers. So they would do a lot of healing, particularly for farmers. They would heal their animals, give poultices and whatnot. And when something goes wrong, they're going to blame them because they're the outsider.
Yeah, absolutely.
And some of the ways of dealing with witches is burning iron, which burning that needle would be in the 1830s, needles were made with iron. So,
well, and if you think about it, they probably wouldn't make this connection because it would have been lost. It would have been folklore, but I'm learning this through my own practice. A needle can be a creation device. So like I have, I can't remember the name of the book proper, but it's a book written by a Ukrainian witch, and it has Ukrainian traditions, and it's got Baba Yaga and embroidery.
Baba Yaga's magic is what it is.
Okay. And it's got embroidery in it. And so needles are, quote unquote, magic and can be magic devices.
Yeah. So the only way to fight magic is with magic.
Or with terribly disrespectful movies about but for real, you mentioned earlier about how we were talking about Gallatin County, the feel of like the Headless Horseman type of thing with all of these threats of imminent danger. And then you go to the county south of that, Harton County, and we're kind of skirting around the eastern side of the state here. There are legends of a headless ghost abound on the back roads of Hardin County, although there's no historical evidence to back it up.
And a headless dog.
There's a headless dog? Now we're talking.
It's on Old Ford's Ferry Road near Potts Hill.
Oh, perfect. Ford's Ferry Road, an early improved trail, a trace road. Led from the ferry landing 3 miles upstream from Cavan Rock into the surrounding hills, eventually linking with trails leading north and west. After James Ford, I'm just reading it, the hill had a bad reputation from a sinister history. Numerous reports of what sounded like groans and blows to the head were reported in the area. Mr. Hobbs encountered the dog, noticing its large size, white breast, and lack of head. Oh, man, the dog trotted with Hobbs, who became frightened and dropped his dinner and fled to a nearby friend. Him and his friend returned. The dinner and the dog were gone. I don't think you can blame the dog for eating the dinner. It didn't have a head.
And it may not even be sinister. That dog may have been protecting him.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Are there instances I am not aware or familiar of any sort of entity that kind of like is known for taking the food of people?
There is. It's right outside. I think it's right outside of Elizabethtown. Do not. The story says to go at midnight. Please don't do it. It is a limestone bluff. You will fall to your death. Don't do it. But apparently if you go at midnight and fry a fish, a black dog will appear and eat the fish.
Oh, yeah, I did read that. I did read that. That was interesting because you wonder.
Oh, there it is. Tower Rock.
Yeah. Oh, there's an emergency going on outside of your home right now.
Oh, it's city life. So that's just all day, every day.
Yeah, I don't get that here. I don't even know if there's anybody else in my town right now. We'll let that clear out a little bit.
No, we could talk hours about the meltdown of the city, you know? Don't want to go down that rabbit hole.
No. Let's get back to Hardin County. We'll revisit the dog story when we get down geographically, when we get there. So the first major feature that's listed in your notes is the Cavan Rock area. And for those of you in my Patreon who have been able to see the documentary in its infancy, that I'd been working on for so long. I go to Cavan Rock, and you can actually see Cavan Rock. We're going to talk about it just a little bit because it's really kind of crazy, the history of this place, right?
Yeah. It's gangs, murders. Mm-hmm. It was
river pirates.
Yeah. Which, funny enough, I don't think it's in this area, but the river pirates got so bad in one area that the cavalry came in, but they couldn't get them out, and eventually it was angry citizens of a town that chased out the river pirates, not the cavalry.
Fascinating. It is the Illinois people's way.
Yep. Government can't do it for us. We're going to do it ourselves.
Any excuse to get a group of people together with torches and pitchforks, man, we are all in. No stop. It's what we do. It's just Tuesday. No, but for real. Yeah, so the Harp brothers, I think, yeah. Wiley and Mike Mikhaijah, we both could be wrong. I don't know any idea like why anyone would be named that. The Harp brothers were some of America's first psychotic serial killers who apparently started their killing spree in Tennessee and then headed to Cave and Rock. And the River Pirates ran them off. That's how bad these guys were. And then they were killed by
conspiracy. It's pretty bad when pirates chase you away.
Yeah, no, it is. An interesting fact about Cave and Rock is not paranormal at all, but it's interesting that in the movie How the West Was Won, there's a scene filmed at the cave, as well as Battery Rock, which I'm not sure is in the notes or not yet, that it's basically, it is almost like a true to life depiction. There's like a bar set up in the cave, and there's some unsavory folks in there. And in the same movie, the street that the house from my dream and my documentary is on serves as the street of New York City. And How the West Was Won, they filmed on that street, which I found out like much later, after my experience in Smithland, Kentucky. But the house that the dream that I found, and then I found the house in real life, that happened on a street where a scene from the same movie was filmed. Fascinating. Kind of crazy.
We have to watch that movie now.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I've seen it a long time ago.
I only watched it after I found out that, you know, these areas were in it. It's pretty wild. Yeah, but Cave and Rock was sort of like the happening place for the bad guys, I guess. You know, it was pretty rough. But also, banshees at Cave and Rock apparently appearing at funerals in the 60s and 70s, according to Jim Young's informant here, who believes it to be a tall tale and that they more likely heard a bird. I've been to Cave and Rock a lot. I've never heard anything that I would attribute to being a banshee, but, you know, I'm only there for maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours at a time. So
a fox, and you know, what's funny.
A fox yell is very much like a woman screaming.
It
remember
is.
You posted that video
here. Yeah. There is a fox that is the size of a German Shepherd or a Golden Retriever in my village that I've seen twice, but we hear it often. I haven't heard it in a while. You know, they move around a lot, but this thing sounds the worst. The worst. It sounds the worst. It's like a woman being stabbed every 40 seconds and you hear it move, you know, like 30 feet at a time. This woman is just being stabbed over and over again, trying to make it across the backcountry of Illinois. It's awful. Yeah. This fox is massive. I tell the story every so often at work, you know, talking to people I work with, and we've decided to call it the werefox. Just because of how big it is, it can't be a normal fox. It's a person that transforms into a fox. That's what we've decided.
There is I don't know what indigenous tribe it's attributed to, but there is legends of slightly larger animals that are like, are they spirits?
It's a spirit. It could also be an emulation of coyote, because coyote will take the shape of a fox as well. In certain native cultures.
Or the trickster. The trickster is the more...
It's a trickster spirit.
Sort of related, kind of not related. The first thing that I noticed whenever I moved to this house in this village, you know, I only moved 5 minutes away from where I was living, right? But the change in the area is so much different. It's much more wildernessy. The first thing I noticed was the difference in animal life here. Which is weird because you're not that far away, but like birds that I had never seen, you know, around my old house. We have a lot of skinks, like little lizards with the blue tails, a lot of squirrels, but I've noticed lately, and I don't know if it's just me reading into it, but I think I've even shared a video on Instagram. There are several deer, a little like, I don't know, what are deer travel in? A herd?
Yes.
A small herd of deer that come on my property a lot. And the neighboring properties. There are two separate pairs of rabbits that also are on my property a lot. And it's normally I will see them I'll go outside at night and then they'll just like look at me. I had a staring contest with one of the deer a couple weeks ago for about 3 minutes. You know, I just feel like maybe I've connected to nature here in a deeper and different way. And I feel like they're just coming to visit me. Like I'm just being like selfish and goofy, but like they're coming to visit me now.
That sounds so lovely. Like that's the one good thing about Victoria is it's city hell, but it's not counties here. It's essentially county. The county we live in is very much about nature. And so they've made these nature sanctuaries in the middle of the city. And it's just like
I've been from me to the computer, like a foot away. I walked by a buck. He was watching me as I was watching him. I said, "You stick me, I'm going to beat the hell out of you."
Dude, my cousin punched a deer one time. That's the dirty version. Here's the full story, and it's very, very brief. But we were out hiking. He was walking backwards, talking to me. And apparently this doe had just been like sleeping in the middle of the afternoon in the woods. And he startles it up. It scares the crap out of him. And out of reflex, he just turns and delivers this discus punch. It hits this deer like in the shoulder as it's like running away. Like it was total like freak accident, would never happen again. But he will every so often call or text me, like, "Hey, will you tell this person the deer story? They don't believe me." And I have to like, yeah, he punched a deer.
Yep.
Yep, it happened.
So funny. Yep.
All right, let's get back and finish talking about Hardin County, because I don't want to keep everyone on for like a huge amount of time here. Because
no, it's
I want,
okay. We love talking about this stuff.
Oh, no, me too. Absolutely. But like I want to really focus on the information that we have, because I'm just so jealous that you have the book and I don't, even though it's my fault I don't have it, apparently.
Big Sink is where the original... It's where they found the original...
Healing spa type thing?
No, that's what you build on top of it. But okay. It's where they originally spring. Discovered the...
It's a spring.
Salt spring.
Salt spring.
And kick-started the salt mining in Illinois.
Oh, really? It says that the landscape is a karst topography, right? Which means it has caves, you know, all over. That those who believe in the old tradition believe that these are gateways to the underworld and strong enhancers for magic. Going back to Cave in Rock, I have witnessed a magical ceremony there by accident, and I didn't watch the entire thing. I was being respectful, but you know, there is an inherent power that you feel in places like this with these caves, especially caves that have access to water in them presently. Like most caves we know have been formed through erosion, underground caves anyway, in the limestone and the sandstone. But to have water presently that flows in and flows out like it does at Cave in Rock, you know, that's so much energy stored there. And the sand on the floor that's being washed out and back into the cave, always, you know, a lot of it stays behind. The whole floor of the cave is sand. And you wonder what kind of energy that's been picked up and deposited by that sand, right?
Yeah, and I wonder how old the sand is too, because Illinois was all ancient seabed.
Yes, it was. The Garden of the Gods area of the Shawnee Forest, there's actually like a hiking path, an observation trail. They have big placards out where it talks about different features and things like that. And that was where I found out that that whole area had once been, you know, a massive ocean, and that all of the stone features that have been kind of carved by the water, that's why they're there, because of that. And I didn't know that before. That's why I remember learning that as a little boy, a young little whippersnapper, a long time ago. So there is a lot of history just in that, you know, and the geology and geography being shaped by being under water for who knows how long, you know?
In certain ways, it enhances conductiveness, spiritual conductiveness of the area.
Absolutely. I mean, because you're talking not only about the water, but you're also talking about the salt. And going back again, you know, that's why we have all these salt deposits and things, because of it being an ocean at one point, right?
Yeah. And limestone.
Yes.
Limestone is notorious for recording.
So I've lived outside of Indiana so long, I don't remember. I remember growing up, limestone was a big paranormal thing. Do you remember why, Jason?
It goes back to the theory of like the tape theory, where energy is recorded into it, sort of, and played back randomly, like the recurring hauntings and things like that. Limestone is one of the big features of that theory, that it holds information like a tape.
One thing I noticed while in Indiana, particularly in the Crown Point area, there's a lot of like the big power lines.
Oh yeah, everywhere.
And I'm assuming through southern Illinois would be the same.
Actually, no. Most of the places that I have been, there's some, obviously, but it's so, especially in the forest, it's so incredibly rural. It likens to me like if you introduced modern electricity into Mayberry, you know, they'd just be putting it on like trees, like running wires from tree to tree. I mean, it's very primitive in a lot of places. And I imagine it causes a lot of power outages and things too, because, you know, a lot of wind being up on hills and things like that. Now, I don't recall seeing a lot of giant power line structures, infrastructure, but I do agree with you about Indiana. Even closer to me, north of Graysville, Indiana, on Highway 63, there is a big stretch of the really large pylons.
So the interesting thing I would think of Illinois is, so you have the limestone, which is the stone tape. You have the tectonic strain theory, which could be like an EMF device, yeah. Right?
Electromagnetic.
It's almost like
energy.
It's a battery for paranormal.
But you also have, as the plates grind on each other, it creates static electricity as well.
Right.
Well, that's
right,
the EM. Right. That's the EM. EMP.
EMP.
And when the tension builds up enough, it releases.
And then you could have, we've described this before. It's like a phenomena bomb goes off.
Mm-hmm.
There's
yeah.
a build up, and then all of a sudden there's a bomb of energy, and a bunch of stuff happens.
So it's almost like it's a battery underneath the feet of everyone in Illinois.
Yeah.
And like, it could explain why, well, you have earthquake lights, but they people have interacted with them, like they're reacting to stimuli. What if it's, because who was it? Someone? Was it Nathan? I think it was on one of Nathan's live streams where he was talking about, I think it was him, or maybe it was Darian. Someone was talking about how the lights might be living entities.
I think it was.
I can't remember who was. I listened to so many of everyone.
It was, I think it was Darian talking about that.
Yeah. And so if you have this tectonic strain theory, like this EMP, they could be feeding off that electricity. Then you have the man-made electricity.
Yeah. Like it knows when the energy is escaping. Right. And so the little ball of light creatures, or whatever they are that are manifesting themselves as a ball of light, they feed on the energy. They absorb the energy from these reliefs. And yeah, that's a good take. For sure. Speaking of beings of energy, I'm looking at some of these ghost stories here. Would you mind sharing John Henson's ghost from your notes, just because of the connection of the experiencer, the name, I thought was interesting?
Yeah, Will Dutton, I'm assuming you're talking about.
Yeah.
Will Dutton, he was passing on a road one night when he saw a friend, John Henson, standing still, silent on the road. Dutton walked up to him and greeted him, but his friend did not acknowledge him or make a sound and floated up into the night sky. Dutton panicked and ran all the way home. A month later, John Henson grew ill and died. Dutton was shaken and in, and it influenced him to take the path of a preacher.
Fascinating. There is a Native American mound in Southern Illinois near Hardin County, or possibly in Hardin County, that is named Dutton Mound. I wonder if it's the same Dutton, or at least some Dutton family. It has to be. It has to be the same family.
It has to be something. At least
Dan
a relative.
Dutton has done genealogy, I think. So I think he would know.
He might be able to bring you up to speed on that.
Oh, yeah. It'd be interesting to look into and just to see. Maybe he's unaware of these stories of people that were in his family, you know, that saw a doppelganger or a spirit of a living man that blasted up into the sky. You know, that's a pretty wild story. I can't imagine coming across that.
There's been instances where people have seen themselves or a close relative.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They're still living when they see them, but it's like they're seeing a ghost.
Yeah, yeah.
We have that famous story here.
Yeah.
On Beacon Hill Park, people saw a woman with like white t-shirt, white pants, and a blonde woman for years standing on this particular rock at Beacon Hill Park for years. And then later, she passed away. I can't remember how she passed away, but they found a woman with black shirt, black pants, brunette hair. And the colors might be different, but it was the opposite color of what people would see for years. Like, this was a documented sighting, and then the woman passed away.
Oh, wow. The Rose Hotel is in the Elizabethtown area. I'm going to look up the exact location.
I will say, for anyone looking for the Rose Hotel, it's only on Airbnb. I was looking at that to try to look at the rooms. They don't have their own booking site. And I think is that the one that's owned by the state?
I'm not sure. I'm looking right now. Reservations through Airbnb. It doesn't say anything about it being owned by the state, but I'm not saying you're wrong.
I could be remembering a different. There's a lot of notes.
There are.
But I was pretty sure I thought it was Elizabethtown.
Maybe you found something. I mean, I'm not digging super deep into it right now, but just looking into it. Oh, yeah. It says on your notes right here. 1960s, the business declined and was in limbo until the state purchased it and reopened it in 2003 as a bed and breakfast.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
Yeah, there you go. We need only look at your own copious amounts of notes. Oh, there's another dog thing. Rock Creek Ghosts.
Oh, yeah, that's the other one. That one just follows them along as they go to church.
Hmm. You know, not necessarily paranormal and not uncommon in rural areas for, you know, you have your dog outside and in the loose, runs around. It could just find some people, and those people go to church on, you know, on Sunday. We'll give dogs a little bit of credit and assume that they know what day it is. So it waits for people to show up to go to church, because sometimes they give them treats, right? And it follows them to church. But it is weird that it's also a black dog, like the black dog of Tower Rock that shows up to eat your fish.
Aren't black dogs fairy dogs sometimes soon?
If their eyes are bright green or look to be flame, they're considered a fey dog or fen hound.
I know Brennan Storr of Ghost Story Guys, our friend, he was in Ireland, I think, and he encountered a black dog. And he was going to this hotel that he thought was his refuge, and the black dog went away, and the hotel was boarded up. He tells the story so well, and when he gets to part of the story where it was boarded up, your heart just goes,
oh my gosh, you're going to die, dude. Yeah.
The next spot that I want to talk about, and that I had mentioned earlier, that there's a spot that's very special to me. This is the Illinois Furnace, the Iron Furnace in Hardin County. So it's not the Iron Furnace itself that feels special to me. So this area, it's a small park area. There's a historical recreation of a working iron furnace. This one is actually not a real iron furnace, but it is pretty darn close to what it would have been like to have seen one in the 1830s. They actually used the bricks from that iron furnace during the Depression. They dismantled it. The Conservation Corps comes in, they take the limestone to use for road gravel, basically. I think it even says that in your notes, but the area, and in your notes, it says there are two fault lines closed, but no reports of anomalous activity. Okay. I'm going to find the iron furnace on Google Maps, and I'm going to show you this area. I don't know if this is something that you looked at or not when you were doing your research. It's kind of a boring thing to look at, but I'm going to share this tab here. Okay. So this area right here is the actual iron furnace. It's kind of a squared off little tower there. If you come down a little ways, this is not a cemetery right here, by the way. There's just a few rocks in the grass. It looks like a cemetery from this, but there's this little bridge right here that goes over Big Creek. And under this bridge, there is a deep well dug out area in this creek. I would say probably 9 feet deep or so. You can kind of see like a sandbar here. It's almost like a parking area, but it's not. There's a big tree that has a rope. People use this as like a swimming hole in the summertime. I've been there sometimes, so there's like 15 people swimming here. But if you venture into the creek and you come down to about right here, the creek swings out closer to the road. But just before, in this bend here, is the spot that for some reason I connect to. I do not hesitate to say at a spiritual level, this place, I don't know what it is. I don't know why. I found it by accident, just sort of showed up there one day, decided, well, there's people in the creek. Maybe I'll go get in the creek too. And I did. And I have never felt more at home in my life, even in my own home, than I do in Big Creek near that bend before it points back towards the road. There's just this hominess to it, this connection to the area. Whenever I am able to calm myself down enough to meditate properly, I always envision myself at the foot of the iron furnace and walking towards the creek and walking out into the creek. And the further along the creek I get, moving towards that power spot, you know, the deeper I relax. That's like my countdown. You know, with every step, I get a little bit more into it, a little bit more relaxed. Yeah, it's just a special place for me.
Sounds kind of like what I envision when I meditate sometimes. We've talked about Enki, and my first encounter with Enki was at the mouth of a river going into the ocean with a weird bridge-like thing over it. And koi fish swimming down into the ocean, which turns into a woman. Turns out that's a Japanese goddess of waters and waterways.
Powerful imagery too.
Yeah, and there I feel completely comfortable there. It's like you say, home.
Mm-hmm. One, and we felt that too. Like, I know exactly what you're talking about, because the downtown hotel in Port Angeles, we used to go there for like weekend trips. It's the foundation. No longer there anymore. The foundation was so badly damaged that it was going to cost way too much money to fix. So they ended up just demolishing it. But the first time we walked in there, we were so cold. Like, it was a bone chilling cold, and we had the heat on turned high, and it was still so cold. And it was almost like the energy there was checking us out. And then after that, when we would walk into this particular room.
It was home.
Yeah. You felt like you were just going home.
Hmm. Yeah. I feel that on a deep level. It's weird.
Spiritual connection.
Yeah. You encounter that. And it's hard to put it into words, right? Like, I know I sit here and say it, like, it's a power spot and it feels like home, and it feels more like home than anywhere. But like, that's not even a rudimentary way to say like how it feels to be in a spot like that. Very powerful.
Well, for you, it is a power spot.
Mm-hmm.
It's a place where your soul connects to nature in a real way.
Yeah. I'm planning to do some experimentation with this spot. I don't want to disclose it yet. I'll wait until I'm closer to
close go camping and relax and enjoy. We're jealous. I'm like, I told AJ after reading this book, I was like, we're never going to get overseas because I pick up a book from another state and I'm like, oh, here's a vacation. Here's a vacation.
Come to Illinois. See our corn and trees.
Shawnee National Forest sounds so nice.
You know, right now, I believe as of 4 or 5 days ago, they closed down a road every year known as Snake Road for a month or so because of the snake migration that takes place. And there are just thousands of snakes crossing this road all day, every day for like a month.
That's in my notes. That area is actually special because it's a there are plants and animals that are nowhere else in the region.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a sanctuary.
Absolutely.
Think of this. A lot of talk about druids and druidic.
We have the Welsh in Kentucky.
The Welsh in Kentucky. The Welsh are, I'm reading a book on Welsh magic right now and Welsh history. They really believe in the fae, in the land spirits. The Welsh who migrated to the US and Canada brought that with them. Like in PEI, there's situations where people were taken by the Fae and dropped back after like 2 or 3 months, and they have no memory of what happened. Usually there's something missing, either an item from them or a body part.
And Nathan was talking about like the Welsh in different parts or the in Kentucky. Reading this book, a lot of people who came to Southern Illinois are from Kentucky.
Yeah.
So those people who were living in Kentucky could have immigrated to Southern Illinois.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and there's the area of Kentucky, Livingston County, that kind of borders the Ohio River there and essentially Illinois. You had from Somerset, UK, Aleister Crowley's great uncle moves to and then marries a woman from Illinois on the other side of the river, Golconda. You know, there's such a marriage of cultures in that area. You know, all the different Native American tribes that were there, the French settlers, the Welsh, you know, you even had stragglers from, you know, the early colonization times, people that are slowly building their families out further west, you know, from England and Scotland and Ireland.
Germany,
for sure. Southern Indiana is very, very German. There's towns like, you know, Hobstadt and places like that, you know, that are incredibly German. You know, so there's a lot of different heritage that all sort of just comes to a confluence here in Southern Illinois, which is fascinating for many reasons, but specifically the folklore that comes along with these people, right? And how that translates to the area that they're in. And you wonder how many of these stories that come up, you know, about lights or about ghosts or dogs that are eating your lunch when they scare you and you drop it or you make fish or whatever. You know, like, what did that translate from? You know, did that come from a story from back home, wherever back home was, you know? Like you mentioned, like the Fae dog, the Finn hounds. And this is why what you guys do with preserving folklore is so important. You know,
it gives access to those hidden pieces of really it equates to history, because a lot of the folklore and myths have basis in actual history, even if it's just a story that was told, that affected people centuries ago. And it may even go back as far as 5,000 years if you're talking about Druidic culture and pre-Druidic cultures like the Welsh. The Welsh go back 8,000 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Into Sumer times. So, and all throughout Europe, there's a lot of history that's just hidden, and it's been trickled down in the stories that the people told.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we're doing this project, so that when people are able to find this, they're actually finding a bit of history about themselves if they have a historical or a familial connection to those lands. Because most of us are immigrants to this land.
Mm-hmm. I think all of us, technically.
Well, yeah, technically. Even Native people are immigrants to this land, whether they came from the far south or over the land bridge at one point.
It's important to remember that, you know, that especially, you know, we live in such a divisive time where everyone is at odds with one another, that there are those that are, you know, not, I don't want to just say racist, but, you know, they don't like that people come from a certain heritage because they aren't from here. But they are also not from here.
Not from here.
Like, what are you even arguing about, you know?
I'm better than you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what it comes down to. I'm better than you because I'm me. And that thinking is kind of wrong. It should be, oh, I am me. I have uniqueness, but so do you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Let's finish off this episode with one of my favorite discoveries from your research into this book, the Glowing Bridge of Hardin County.
This isn't even paranormal.
Nope.
It's a glowing fungus that exists in southern Illinois. It's called foxfire fungus.
Now, a note of point, Adam, in his work with tombstones, mm-hmm. found that some tombstones have this fungus on them and glow. There are literal legends in areas about glowing tombstones.
I had to talk to Adam because he knows about tombstones, because there's legends in southern Illinois about glowing tombstones. So I asked him, and he's like, funny you say that. I asked him like 4 days after he posted a video about it.
Hmm. Adam Tallis, who we're talking about here, our good friend Adam.
Yes. Yes. But this legend is, he cut down a dying tree because he needed a bridge and he had a dead tree. And he built a bridge. And then him and his friend were doing whatever men did at night after long days of work.
It's a secret. You don't want to know anyway.
And they see this glow and they thought that the forest was on fire. So they ran out there, and the bridge and the tree stump were just aglow with fungus, like these sinewy strands.
Think that's a mycelial, like a mycelial type structure.
Oh yeah, Southern Illinois is lots of swamp and forest. I guarantee there's a fungal network in the forest.
Oh, absolutely. Very big mushroom hunting, mushroom harvesting that goes on down there. A lot of morel mushroom hunters hit up the Shawnee Forest and have their little private spots and things.
Beautiful eating.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, man.
My favorite.
Have a nice fire, cook up some mushrooms, have a nice cold beer. That'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so this fungus actually exists in the forest, so if anyone's hiking in the forest
and they see glow.
You see glow. It's fungus.
Yeah, I'm going to have to make a note to look specifically for foxfire fungus next time I'm down in Hardin County. I'd really like to know exactly where this bridge was and if it's still there. I doubt it is. I mean, it was an old wooden bridge from whatever, but
yeah, there was no, like some places he gives no discerning information. And I don't know if that's because it seems like it was one of those, like, locals talk to him. So, like, some of the stories, he may not have been able to find historical records, but it might have been a tale.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay, so we managed to take about, like, an hour and a half to talk about two counties that are mentioned in this wonderful book. And, again, this goes back to your amazing research that you've done and your impeccable note-taking. And I do want to revisit this in the future and hit up some more counties. And I'll do a better job of, like, scouting, you know, what I want to talk about specifically and not so much doing it on the fly. But thank you so much for stopping in, guys, and hanging out in the patio.
Yeah, it was fun.
I absolutely love it because this is like, you know, you're talking almost about my home. You know, I'm a couple hours away from these places, but I do feel like more than any other topic that I have covered on the show, this is
near and dear.
Yeah, this is me. This is my land, you know, the land of Lincoln, even though he was born not here and died not here.
You've got a whole list of places you can go and explore now. Like, we're jealous, like all of the like weekend trips you can take with history and, and forests. Like, as soon as I read about the Crab Orchard, I was like, oh, I want to go camping there and find Mothman.
You know, of all the times that I have visited Shawnee Forest, I've only camped there one time. Nothing eventful happened, but it was really hot. It was actually on my birthday, and it was like last minute decision. I don't remember what birthday it was. It was a long time ago, but yeah, no, nothing eventful happened. There were a lot of raccoons in the campground. I remember that. It was miserably hot. Just sweat all night, get up at like 4 o'clock in the morning and just be done. Like, I'm tired of trying to sleep. You know?
Oh, I don't miss that heat at all, but it's getting that hot here. We broke down by an air conditioner because we were like, no, no.
Oh man, I can't imagine life here without an air conditioner. It would just be awful.
I equate it to the valley in Nova Scotia.
Hmm.
In the middle of summer, it goes up to, well, to put it in perspective, it was 54 Celsius last year.
So that is, you're getting into the hundreds, I think.
It's like 120, 125 range.
Man.
It's too hot.
And it just, it cooks.
129.2 degrees Fahrenheit, 54 degrees Celsius. That's hot.
Yeah.
And they're saying it's going to get 1 degree hotter every year.
Yeah, that's what we do. It's a price to pay to have electronics and have this podcast for everyone to listen to. Yeah. The price we pay. You know, things will change.
That's why we do podcasting in the summertime, so we can stay out of the heat.
We have our air conditioner cranked up. We're inside. The lights are drawn.
Yep. Thank you guys so much again for coming on.
And thank you. It was fun.
It was great. As usual, we get into the weird intricacies everything.
It's like a rabbit hole within a rabbit hole with this book. Like, I haven't done any more research because I'm getting ready for Earth Day, but like, as soon as he mentioned something, I went to Amazon. I'm like, there's $3.
All of our archived episodes are available for free right now at patreon.com/beyondthepatio or on our YouTube channel. Follow us on social media. Give us a like if you don't mind. And if you have anything weird happen to you and you want to share the tale, hit me up at paranormalpatio@gmail.com.